Army's arsenal. Lewis's purpose was to obtain arms and ammunition for his party. He could select from existing stock or order items made special for the expedition by the arsenal's craftsmen. He carried a letter to the superintendent of the arsenal from Secretary of War Dearborn. "You will be pleased to make such arms and ironwork as requested by the bearer, Captain Meriwether Lewis, and to have them completed with the least possible delay." When he had what was needed, he would arrange for it to be shipped to Pittsburgh, then hurry on to Philadelphia for more schooling and shopping. At Harper's Ferry, he got 15 muzzle-loading, flintlock, long-barreled rifles, sometimes called Kentucky, but more properly, Pennsylvania rifles. They were the sine qua non of the expedition. On them depended the food supply and self-defense. They were absolutely dependable. The U.S. Model 1803, the first rifle specifically designed for the U.S. Army, 54 caliber with a 33-inch barrel. Lewis referred to these weapons as short rifles, for they were considerably shorter than the civilian Pennsylvania rifle. The Model 1803 delivered a lead slug on target with sufficient velocity to kill a deer at a range of about 100 yards. An expert could get off 2 aimed shots in 1 minute. Lewis also selected pipe tomahawks and ordered the artisans at Harper's Ferry to make 3 dozen. He picked up fish gigs, knives, and so on. Mainly, however, he supervised the construction of the iron boat frame. It was so important to him that he stayed on at Harper's Ferry for a month instead of the week he had planned. This was cutting into the time Jefferson had wanted him to spend in Philadelphia. On April 22nd, having heard nothing from Lewis since March 7th, Jefferson learned in reports from others about Lewis's delay at Harper's Ferry. With Lewis gone, the president needed a secretary. He had selected a young man, Lewis Harvey of Virginia, but had put off announcing the appointment for reasons he explained in a letter to Harvey. Jefferson had been living in the daily expectation that the stage of the day would bring back Captain Lewis, and that then, within a few days, he would set out on his Mississippi expedition. Jefferson also said that he had put off writing because my great regard for Captain Lewis made me unwilling to show a haste to fill his place before he was gone, and to counteract also a malignant and unfounded report that I was parting with him from dissatisfaction, a thing impossible either from his conduct or my dispositions toward him. Washington will have its gossip. Jefferson was extremely sensitive to it, but far more important to him was Lewis's delay. He was almost desperate because of it, but he subdued his feelings and wrote Lewis with some care in his word choices. "I have no doubt you have used every possible exertion to get off, and therefore we have only to lament what cannot be helped, as the delay of a month now may lose a year in the end." Lewis might have read that as an expression of confidence, but on second reading wondered if it was a complaint. Most likely the former. In any case, he knew Jefferson would understand and would agree with his judgment on priorities. Jefferson's letter of complaint crossed Lewis's explanation for the delay, a frequent occurrence given the maddeningly slow mails. Lewis described his activities. Besides arranging for the rifles, knives, and other equipment, he had written to the commander at Southwest Post to request help in getting suitable volunteers. The soldier volunteers could be promised their regular pay and a reward of land grants. Lewis anticipated gathering his party as he made his way to St. Louis that summer and strengthening it through personnel selection as the expedition proceeded, rejecting the weak, ignorant, and unmanageable for the strong, skilled, and eager volunteers. He told Jefferson he intended to be ruthless about it. He had written to a congressman from Tennessee requesting that he find a boat builder in Nashville who could make a boat and a canoe for the expedition. These and other matters took longer than he had expected. But by far the biggest cause of delay was Lewis's experimenting with the boat he and Jefferson had dreamed up. Every day he was at the worksite because he was convinced that without his personal attention, the workmen would never understand the design. He carried out some sophisticated experiments with 2 different designs, one curved, the other semi-cylindrical, the former for the stem and stern, the latter for the body of the boat. He triumphantly reported to Jefferson that the frame would weigh only 44 pounds, whereas the boat, when covered with hide, would carry 1,770 pounds. Lewis told Jefferson, I was induced from the result of this experiment to direct the iron frame of the canoe to be completed. He had made his first important independent decisions, where to spend his fast disappearing time and what boat to build. This was the beginning of a new relationship with Jefferson. Though Lewis was not yet quite out of the reach of the president's communiques, he was not far short of it. Witness his decision to stay 3 extra weeks at Harper's Ferry, despite his knowledge that Jefferson desperately wanted him to get to Philadelphia to study and then get on the road. In mid-April, Lewis set off to the east. He stopped first in Frederickstown, where on April 15th he wrote General William Irvin, superintendent of military stores, with headquarters in Philadelphia. Lewis said he wanted Irvin to purchase for him some necessary articles. First on the list was portable soup, a dried soup of various beans and vegetables that Lewis may have used during his travels as an army paymaster. In any case, he was enthusiastic about it. He told Irvin, "Portable soup, in my opinion, forms one of the most essential articles in the preparation for the expedition, and fearing that it cannot be procured readily in such quantity as is requisite, I take the liberty to request that you will procure 200 pounds of it for me," or however much was available on the market. "I have supposed that the soup would cost about $1 per pound. Should it, however, come much higher, then quantity must be limited by the sum of 250 pounds, as more cannot be expended." In the end, Lewis spent $289.50 on 193 pounds of portable soup, by far the highest sum for any area of provisions. He spent as much for dried soup as he had originally estimated for his instruments, arms, and ammunition. On April 19th, Lewis arrived in Lancaster. He went immediately to the home of Andrew Ellicott, America's leading astronomer and mathematician. Jefferson had earlier written Ellicott to ask him to teach Lewis to make celestial observations, and Ellicott had replied, "Mr. Lewis's first object must be to acquire a facility and dexterity in making the observations, which can only be obtained by practice." Lewis and Ellicott wasted no time. On April 20th, Lewis reported to Jefferson, "I have commenced, under his direction, my observations, etc., to perfect myself in the use and application of the instruments." He found Ellicott to be extremely friendly and attentive, and I am confident is disposed to render me every aid in his power. He thinks it will be necessary I should remain here 10 or 12 days. While at Lancaster, Lewis picked up additional rifles. How many is not known, nor why he couldn't get all he wanted at Harper's Ferry. They may have been improved models, since Lancaster was the manufacturing center for long rifles. But his list of necessary items and of quantities required continued to grow, indicating that at Harper's Ferry he had decided the expedition had to be a party considerably larger than a dozen men. Another thought had come into his head, that another officer would be required. No evidence exists as to when or even if he discussed either of these critical matters with Jefferson, but how could he have failed to do so? Lewis's schooling in Lancaster in the use of sextant, chronometer, and other instruments took longer than Ellicott had anticipated. Not until May 7th was he ready to go to Philadelphia. The ride from Lancaster to Philadelphia took him over the most modern highway in America, completed in 1795, made of broken stone, the country's first gravel road. Stage wagons were able to average 5 to 7 miles per hour on it. Going that fast in a stage was a new experience for Lewis. In Philadelphia, he went to Patterson, who continued his instruction. With Patterson's help, he selected a chronometer. He bought it from Thomas Parker, a clock and watchmaker on South 3rd Street, for $250, by far the largest sum expended for any single item carried on the expedition. Lewis sent it to Ellicott to be regulated with this note: "I have at length been enabled to procure a chronometer which you will receive, and you will also receive with her a screwdriver and key. The inner cases of the chronometer are confined by a screw. She is wound up and the works are stopped by inserting a hog's bristle, which you will discover by examination. She has been cleaned by Mr. Voigt and her rate of going ascertained by observation to be 14 minutes too slow in 24 hours. Jefferson sent Lewis a current draft of his instructions, asking Lewis to comment and to circulate the draft among the various savants in Philadelphia for their comments and suggestions. Lewis worried about a phrase in the draft that indicated that the scientific instruments had already been provided. By whom, he wondered. What were they? He asked Jefferson for a list so that he could consult with Patterson and Ellicott to make certain nothing had been omitted. He further informed Jefferson that his teachers both disapprove of the theodolite, which Jefferson had told Lewis would be his best instrument for accurate measurements. It was a delicate instrument, difficult of transportation, and one that would be very liable to get out of order, and anyway it was much more inaccurate than the sextant. His teachers agreed on what instruments would be indispensably necessary. They were two sextants, an artificial horizon or two, a good Arnold's watch or chronometer, a surveyor's compass with a ball and socket and two-pole chain, and a set of plotting instruments. There was just a hint of a reminder in the letter that the decision-making power for the expedition was coming into Lewis's hands. Jefferson acknowledged as much in his reply, regretting the impression which has been misunderstood. The draft Lewis had of the instructions would not be dated until the day he departed. Jefferson had assumed that by then Lewis would have made his selections and purchases. As to the theodolite, Jefferson told Lewis to do whatever Patterson and Ellicott recommended. Lewis was in Philadelphia through much of May and the first week in June. He made the rounds of the city, the list he and Jefferson had drawn up in hand, making purchases: fishing tackle, lead canisters, medicines, dry goods, tobacco, shirts. He spent $2,324. Herewith a sampling of the items he purchased: 6 papers of ink powder, sets of pencils, crayons, 200 pounds of best rifle powder, and 400 pounds of lead, 4 gross fishing hooks assorted, 25 axes, woolen overalls and other clothing items, including 30 yards common flannel, 100 flints, 30 steels for striking or making fire, 6 large needles and 6 dozen large awls, 3 bushels of salt. He bought oilskin bags to protect the instruments and journals. He got mosquito netting and field tables and large multipurpose sheets of oiled linen, each 8 by 12 feet, for tents, and candles so that he could ride at night. The sheets of oiled linen could double up as sails by day. For Indian presents, 5 pounds of white glass beads, mostly small, and 20 pounds of red assorted beads, 144 small cheap scissors, 288 common brass thimbles, 10 pounds of assorted sewing thread, silk, paint and vermilion, 288 knives, combs, armbands, and ear trinkets. Lewis insisted on taking a preponderance of blue beads because they were far more valued than the white beads of the same manufacture and answer all the purposes of money. The emphasis was on the gay and gaudy rather than the useful. Although Lewis called them presents, they were trade goods. He did not intend to give them away. Rather, he would use them to purchase goods and services from the Indians. Lewis and Clark scholar Paul Russell Cutright writes, "It was no small task to anticipate all that he would need in the way of arms, food, clothing, camping paraphernalia, scientific instruments, and Indian presents for a party of still undetermined size that, for an indefinite period of time, would be out of touch with normal supply sources." How well he had done, only the event could tell. One small peek ahead is appropriate here, however, because it reveals so much about Lewis and the point of view he held. During the expedition, the party ran out of many useful or pleasure-giving items, including tobacco, whiskey, salt, and blue beads. A frontiersman could live without those things. The expedition ran short of, but never out of, many critical items. But when it got home, the expedition had sufficient powder and lead to repeat the journey, and plenty of rifles. Lewis had arranged at Harper's Ferry for lead canisters that, when melted down, made exactly the right number of balls for the amount of powder in the canister. Lewis had the frontiersman's faith in his rifle. As long as a man had his rifle, ammunition, and powder, he would take on anything the wilderness could throw at him. Lewis also had plenty of ink left when he got home, enough for another voyage. That ink wasn't critical to making the trip, but it was critical to making the expedition a success by recording its findings. Lewis had his priorities right. The purchase of the soup was a serious cost overrun. Along with the extra rifles he purchased in Lancaster, the amount indicates that the more he thought about what he might encounter, the larger the size of the party was becoming in his imagination. The amounts of medicine he purchased also indicate he now planned to take many more than a dozen men. His medical advisor was Dr. Benjamin Rush, a member of the American Philosophical Society, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and the most eminent American physician of the day. On May 17th, Lewis called on him at his home on the corner of Walnut and 4th Streets, bringing along Jefferson's draft instructions for Rush's comments. They talked. Rush gave advice, beginning with, "When you feel the least indisposition, do not attempt to overcome it by labor or marching. Rest in a horizontal posture. Also, fasting and diluting drinks for a day or two will generally prevent an attack of fever. To these preventatives of disease may be added a gentle sweat obtained by warm drinks or gently opening the bowels by means of one, two, or more of the purging pills." Those pills were under Dr. Rush's patent, known as Rush's pills, but generally referred to as thunderclappers. As far as Rush was concerned, they were sovereign for nearly all mankind's ills. They were composed of calomel, a mixture of 6 parts mercury to 1 part chlorine, and jalap. Each drug was a purgative of explosive power. The combination was awesome. Mercury had an even more important role in Lewis's pharmacy. It was the treatment of choice for syphilis, and remained so until the advent of penicillin during World War II. Another piece of advice from Dr. Rush: after long marches or much fatigue from any cause, you will be more refreshed by lying down in a horizontal posture for 2 hours than by resting a much longer time in any other position of the body. There is no evidence of Lewis's asking the good doctor what he thought they would be encountering out there. Lewis reported to Jefferson, "Dr. Rush has favored me with some abstract queries under the several heads of physical history, medicine, morals, and religion of the Indians, which I have no doubt will be serviceable in directing my inquiries among that people." Rush's questionnaire asked about the diseases of the Indians and their remedies, at what age menstruation began and ended, the age of marriage, how long they suckled their children, the state of the pulse in the morning, at noon, and at night, before and after eating. At what time did they rise? What about baths, murder, suicide? Do they employ any substitute for ardent spirits to promote intoxication? Any animal sacrifices in their religion? What affinity between their religious ceremonies and those of the Jews? Here, Rush was looking for the fabled lost tribe of Israel. More realistically, how do they dispose of their dead, and with what ceremonies do they inter them? It was an eclectic list of questions, some silly, some stunningly on the mark. They illustrated how little could even be guessed about the nature of the Indian tribes of the West, or their numbers. In addition to the questionnaire, Rush prepared a medical list for Lewis, amounting to $90.69 for drugs, lancets, forceps, syringes, and other supplies. It included 50 dozen Rush's pills, along with 30 other kinds of drugs. Those most used were Peruvian bark, jalap, opium, glauber salts, nitre, i.e. potassium nitrate or saltpeter, tartar emetic, laudanum, calomel, and mercurial ointment. The drugs Lewis bought contained 1,300 doses of physic, 1,100 of emetic, 3,500 of diaphoretic, sweat inducer, and more, including drugs for blistering, salivation, and increased kidney output, along with tourniquets and clister syringes. While at Harper's Ferry, Lewis had thought of bringing a doctor along, but by May he evidently had decided he himself would be the doctor. He had learned from his mother a great deal about herbs and simples and herb therapy, and wasn't afraid to experiment. Like all frontiersmen, he knew how to set a broken bone or remove an embedded bullet or arrow, how to cope with croup or dysentery. Rush was impressed by Lewis. He wrote Jefferson, "His mission is truly interesting. I shall wait with great solicitude for its issue. Mr. Lewis appears admirably qualified for it. May its advantages prove no less honorable to your administration than to the interests of science." It wasn't all work. Lewis did a considerable amount of socializing in Philadelphia with his friend Malan Dickerson. They moved in the highest social circles. Dinner one evening with Jefferson's great friend Dr. George Logan, another evening with Governor Thomas McKean at his mansion on the northeast corner of 3rd and Pine Streets. By day, Lewis expanded his studies. He went to Dr. Benjamin Smith Barton, professor at the University of Pennsylvania and author of the first textbook on botany in the United States, just published when Lewis came to him. Barton lived a few steps from Independence Hall at 44 North 5th Street. He had studied in England and Germany, and he had made fairly extensive field trips in Pennsylvania. He was mesmerized by the expedition. The thought of all that was waiting to be discovered tempted him so much that he talked with Lewis about the possibility of going along. Lewis was enthusiastic about the idea. Barton would certainly be an asset in collecting and describing, but he was 37 years old, a scholar, not a soldier. "I fear the doctor will not carry this design into effect," Lewis told Jefferson, rightly, as it turned out. Still, Barton made important contributions. He taught Lewis how to preserve specimens, either plant or bird or animal skin. He taught Lewis the importance of specimen labels, including place and date of collection. Barton expanded Lewis's vocabulary and range of knowledge. In a painstaking study on the scientific writing of Lewis, Elijah Criswell compiled a list of almost 200 different technical terms the captain employed in describing new plants and animals, a quantity showing, in Criswell's words, "a remarkable knowledge for an amateur of scientific, especially botanical, descriptive terminology." Dr. Caspar Wister was the last of the Philadelphia savants Lewis turned to for education. Wister held the chair of anatomy at the University of Pennsylvania and had published the first American textbook on anatomy. He was also a member of the American Philosophical Society and the foremost authority on fossils in America. He talked with Lewis about that anomalous beast, the Megalonyx, which he